Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Greetings and welcome to Homeopathy World Communities, Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. This is your weekly co-host, Alan Phillips, along with Debbie Brock. Debbie's not able to join us today. I think we have Greg on the line. Is that you, Greg?
Hi, Alan. How are you doing?
Just fine. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you.
Happy New Year, Greg.
All right.
This is going to be a big one, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah.
I think
2012 will be the year of predictions.
Well, there's a lot of focus from a lot of different times and cultures and places on this year, so it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. Though I think this is a very interesting time in our civilization, in a time scheme broader than merely a single year, but it will be very interesting. Debbie's, I think you know, Greg, was having some computer problems and other things going on. She's not with us right at the moment. I don't know if she's going to be in during the show, but let's just go ahead and go forward with what you had planned to talk about today. Greg Glazers, for those of you who maybe have not caught Greg on past shows, is an outstanding attorney from California, has just done incredible research into vaccine rights, and in particularly in the context of martial law and extreme circumstances and situations, which is a whole entire separate category to itself from vaccine rights in routine circumstances, which is where the greater area of my own focus is. So always delighted, Greg, to have you on board and to help educate me, I say selfishly, but also for all of our listeners as well.
I'm happy to be here, and thanks for the intro, Alan. Yeah, so
you're
our
welcome.
First topic is...
I'm sorry, if there's anything else you want to add about what you do, just to fill that out, by all means, feel free, and otherwise, or afterwards, take us on into what you'd like to focus on today.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we can jump right into it. So, as you mentioned, it is a very interesting year in the broader sense as well, of just an interesting time frame. And before we jump into our first topic, which is what is due process in the health freedom context, I was thinking that we could talk a little bit about this article that just came out in naturalnews.com. It was written by Mike Adams, and it has 25 predictions for the year 2012 and beyond. And his prediction number 16 is that, quote, the next pandemic will be spread by scientists working for the vaccine manufacturers, close quote. And I wanted to gather your thoughts on that, Alan.
Well, you know, Greg, I spent, as you may know, I've been involved in the vaccine controversy in one way or another, for the better part of 18 years now. Since my 18-year-old son was born is when I first stumbled on the issue. And I spent the majority of those years either ignoring or laughing at or otherwise dismissing many of the so-called conspiracy theories, and in particular those that were talking about some sort of plan to depopulate the world.
I
still don't have
I was in the same, you know, just
I still don't have a firm position
for the longest time. Went all the way through law school.
We're both going to stop and start together, aren't we? Here, I was just going to say, the whole vaccine issue has been an ongoing learning curve for me for those 18 years, and God willing, it will keep on going because there's always more to learn and know in the law and in the politics and medicine and so forth. But the one issue in fairly recent history, I think, that really tipped me over and opened up a new area of consideration for me was the event back in early 2009, February of 2009. Now, I'm drawing a blank here on the particular vaccine manufacturer that sent contaminated vaccines all over Europe and contaminated with live avian bird flu virus. Now, the medical folks I've talked to have said it's not possible for that to have been an accident. It's not a situation where one psycho with a vat of bird, with a test tube of bird flu virus can slip in at night because he has a key and pour that into a vat and ha ha ha, I've contaminated all the vaccines. It really, because of these what are called bio-level safety tree protocols, it really is a group process. There's very strict control. And according, again, to the folks I've spoken to with knowledge about this, they say a group of people would had to have known that that was going on. But even if it was an accident, is that an industry where those kind of accidents could happen that you want to be required to get a product from them? And so it was only by chance or the grace of God, whatever you want to attribute it to, that Czech research scientists who weren't required to test the flu vaccine material decided to test it anyway, as I understand it, and they found the contamination and it wasn't spread. But I can only think of two reasons for a vaccine company to do that. And it's either to create illness so they can profit by treating that, or it's to kill people. And we know potentially there was a mixture of avian bird flu and seasonal bird flu. The avian bird flu is lethal but not transmissible, particularly among humans, and the seasonal flu the other way around. And so that was a potentially deadly biological weapon.
Yeah, that was, and the company was Baxter.
Baxter, thank you. I was thinking Glaxo. I knew the X, but I knew that wasn't right. So that's where I'm at the point now where I recognize that accident or intentional, man-created pandemics can occur. And there's certainly some evidence, as I know you're aware, to suggest that the recent swine flu pandemic was not a work of nature alone, either.
Right, right. Yeah, the writing's on the wall, and there are many excellent journalists who have gone out of their way to show that there is a level of conspiracy here that goes beyond the typical national fervor. This is international in character, and in the memo that I have given to the Pandemic Response Project, and which is up on the pandemicresponseproject.org website, I have a whole section entitled New World Order. And I just call it New World Order because it's a very common phrase that is immediately recognizable as, oh, okay, well, let's talk a little bit about conspiracies. And I lay out there just a list of useful books and websites and articles that cover some of this information, in particular about vaccines, but also about other things that are very relevant, like chemtrails and HARP and military technology and black ops and things of that nature. And the powers that orchestrate chaos of this type or depopulation have very sophisticated methods that go beyond the traditional weaponry and into the things that are commonplace in society. Food can be weaponized by, for example, creating genetically modified organisms that will harm the immune system and disrupt DNA patterns. And medicine can be weaponized in the sense that if people get hooked on drugs and surgery as the panaceas for modern illnesses, then statistically you'll find that this degrades society's health over time to a certain degree that will contribute to depopulation. And it's very scientific in one sense because it can be calculated to a certain degree. And recognizing where things are being weaponized is a matter of both, you know, diligent independent research and a bit of common sense. I remember writing a while back that a good hypocrisy meter is more useful than an MD, a JD, and a PhD put together. If you know how to research these things, you can really come out with a useful library of information. You know, whether or not you draw ultimate conclusions isn't really the point. And I often don't think the point is to draw an ultimate conclusion, but rather just be aware of what the circumstances are and what the potential threats are, what the risks are, so that you can make a smart choice. And even things that seem totally innocuous, like fluoride in the water, can turn out to be the product of a very dangerous history, which you wouldn't know, which you wouldn't know just by common sense. You'd really have to look into it. You know, I mean, you might, even if you knew that fluoride was a product of aluminum manufacturing, you might think, oh, well, you know, that's a heavy metal, that might be dangerous. You might have to look into it and say, oh, look, here the military did experiments and found that it made soldiers docile. You know, so around lurking around corners, we find these dangerous factors in society. So here on the which actually leads us into our topic, which is tyranny lurking behind the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. And then we also have another topic, which is due process in the health freedom context. So I suppose we should just launch right into it. What do you think, Alan?
Let's go for it.
Okay. So due process comes from the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, due process has two components, substantive and procedural. Substantive due process is your actual rights to life, liberty, and property. And then procedural due process is how you achieve those procedurally in terms of right to cross-examine witnesses, court hearing, right to counsel, and so forth. And the two are interlocked, substantive and procedural due process, because they tend to feed off one another. And some of the major cases in the health freedom context decided by the United States Supreme Court have explored those the principle of interlocking due process in more detail. So let's just start off with reading a quote from the case of Washington versus Glucksberg. This is a seminal case from 1990. The due process clause guarantees more than fair process, and the liberty it protects includes more than the absence of physical restraint. The clause also provides heightened protection against government interference with certain fundamental rights and liberty interests. In a long line of cases, we have held that, in addition to the specific freedoms protected by the Bill of Rights, the liberty specially protected by the due process clause includes the rights to bodily integrity. We have also assumed and strongly suggested that the due process clause protects the traditional right to refuse unwanted life-saving medical treatment. Close quote. So there you have it from the Supreme Court. It's very well recognized that you have the right to refuse medical treatment. Now, the recently proposed Model State Emergency Health Powers Act requires compulsory medical treatment if you've been diagnosed with a contagious disease. Additionally, this proposed law says that the government can forcibly test you to see if you have a contagious disease in the event that there is a declared emergency. So here we have a very dangerous situation. It's this proposed act. Now, not all states have implemented this proposed law, but this is the type of proposed law that could be implemented very quickly in the event of panic. And parts of it have already been implemented by the states.
And so, I just want to point out on that note there that this is something that was issued just about roughly 3 months after 9/11, and it seemed to me to be not coincidental that there was a wave of fear that they were riding on there that I think probably facilitated the implementation of parts of this model law into actual state laws around the country. Do you have a thought about that as well?
Very specific information on that point. Sue Blevins, the president of the Institute for Health Freedom, pointed out the proposed law was accepted for publication in March of 2011, but it was held for publishing until after September 11th. So it's like this was the agenda was already there, and they just waited for the right time to release it. And the powers behind this that drafted this, including Lawrence Gostin, it comes from the Center for Law and Public Health at Georgetown and Johns Hopkins Universities. And if you look closer at these organizations, this is a federally funded project, and with very, very close ties in management, at executive levels between the university and the United States military. So what we have here is a U.S. military-sponsored power grab, which is a proposed law that goes hand-in-hand with other martial law-type legislation out there. Right now, the NDAA is getting a lot of attention. The Patriot Act got a lot of attention in the past, and there's this one. When you put them all together, what you have is it's an amalgam. It's this thing where even lawyers have a difficult time deciphering where the applicable powers are and then how to implement these powers. And so the authorities on the ground who are not lawyers are going to be relying on summary sheets, fact sheets, FAQ statements, that come out from the powers that be. They'll be going on to the Center for Disease Control website to try to find out where the powers are. They'll be looking at the memos that come down. They aren't going to be reading the texts of the law themselves. So although I'll be talking about some of the text of the law and, happy to go into some of these details, on the ground, one of the most important things to realize is, what is the government's position? How do they interpret this proposed law? And so I looked at that, the Congressional Research Service, and they write that, quote, with respect to the preservation of the public health in cases of communicable disease outbreaks, these powers may include the enactment of mandatory vaccination laws. And we also find this quote, current federal regulations do not include any mandatory vaccination programs. Rather, such measures as quarantine and isolation are generally utilized to halt the spread of communicable disease. If a person refuses to be vaccinated, he or she may be quarantined during the public health emergency, giving rise to the vaccination order. Close quote.
And so that was where is that from?
It's called Mandatory Vaccinations, Precedent, Current Laws, Kathleen Swenneman, February 4, 2011. Now, that matches my research into vaccination specifically, but that's just vaccination. When you look at forced medical treatment, then it's under different – it's categorized differently than vaccination is. But oftentimes we also find – but that's just in the proposed laws. And again, that statement from Kathleen Swenneman was just an overview of law. And so – which was the point I was trying to make, it's that there's going to be a general in the event of an emergency, there's going to be a general confusion as to what is the applicable law and who are the applicable agencies to implement that law. And so these agencies will put together summary sheets, and memos that will explain what our rights are under the laws, and we can expect them to be very deferential to government authority. Now, compare, here's a scholar, a legal scholar, who says that, quote, even in an emergency, when there is a rapidly spreading contagious disease and an effective vaccine, the state is not permitted to forcibly vaccinate or medicate anyone. The constitutional alternative is to segregate infected and exposed people separately to prevent them from transmitting the disease to others, close quote. Now, that was Wendy Mariner writing in 2005. And my research matches Mariner's, that there's no authority that allows the government to forcibly vaccinate or medicate anyone. The government's taking a different position based on their interpretation of Jacobson and based on their recently enacted legislation. Now, there's sort of a unique undercurrent that's very specific to law, which I think Alan and I, we should explain to our listeners who aren't as familiar with federal and state power. Now, typically, it's the state government that has the power to enact public health measures and is responsible for the police power, governing the day-to-day affairs of the people within constitutional limits. And the federal government has a limited role. This is a republic. The government is a republic, and so it's the federal government has narrow powers. Now,
right, and it also has to do, I think, just with the context. Most of the issues we're dealing with infectious disease are a state context. There are a few jurisdictions that are sort of exclusively federal. For example, airspace is considered a federal jurisdiction, you know, and interstate travel and spread of disease, or international, you know, in and out of the country, those things. But most of us, when we're dealing with infectious disease issues, are, as you said, Greg, going to be dealing with, first and foremost, at least, initially, state authority. But there's sort of a separate question there that we can get into if you'd like, and if time allows, about how and when these different jurisdictions may or may not interact. You know, even if you have something, for example, that's purely a state law issue, an outbreak in the middle of Kansas that doesn't have any risk of crossing borders, is that something that nevertheless federal authorities could be involved in, and if so, how and why and so forth? But anyway, please continue.
Yeah, sure. So in reviewing this proposed legislation, what I found is a specific amount of federal and state cooperation. In fact, an entire article, Article 4 of this proposed legislation, is devoted to federal and state cooperation. And on the surface, this might not seem like a big deal. You know, you think, oh, okay, yeah, it makes sense. You know, governments are cooperating. You know, we've all seen that Denzel Washington movie where, you know, this is my jurisdiction, you know. And but what's really going on behind the scenes here is that the state has more power than the federal government. And the federal government wants to enact these sweeping power measures. So if they can get the state to cooperate with the federal government, then they can get state powers. It's like swallowing the state and saying, you know, we recognize you local governments, you know, all you public health authorities, all you sheriffs out there, that you have more power than we have. So we want to invite you to shake hands with us. And so what this does is, by usurping traditional powers, it ensures that public health measures are less subject to legal attack on the grounds of exceeding federal powers. And it allows a back door for regulations that would otherwise be rejected by the constituency. Because like a local constituency could just reject it. You have like a little safe haven bubble, you know, where people would gravitate to, oh, look, you know, our rights are more protected in Mayberry. Let's all go there. But with a federal preemption situation of Fed-State cooperation, once you give that power to the Fed, it's difficult to take it back. And another thing that I found harrowing in the proposed law was a section devoted to private partnerships, where the government is teaming up with corporations to provide necessary resources. And this, of course, reminds us of fascism. You know, that's what fascism is. It's a public and private cooperation where the government delegates to private corporations or private entities the ability to carry out government functions, and that has a you know, an underbelly of profit making. And so it's just like a complex beast, really, is what it is. And in the bigger picture, it's when I review these proposed laws, I see that it's sort of a catch-22. They've got you in the government has a win-win situation. You either fall in line and take your shots or get your forced medical treatment, then your immune system is compromised, you know, and they've allowed you to, you know, sort of sold your conscience to suffer the fate of a coward. Or alternatively, you can refuse the treatment like a man, and then they haul you off to quarantine prison where they've got you anyway. So it's a catch-22. And in one sense, and I find it very dissettling. And so it's nice to find legal scholars out there who will stand up for the rights of individuals. So, for example, this one scholar I found, Wendy Mariner, really did just that, standing up and saying, look, you know, there is no right to forced medical treatment, no right to forced vaccination, and that the alternative is to have isolation or quarantine. Now, I think that Mariner was saying that there's also a right to self-quarantine. So if you find yourself in a situation of pandemic or emergency declared in your area, that you have the ability to stay on your own private property or in a safe place and refuse medical treatment. Because if we don't have that, we don't have that right to say that forced medical treatment is unlawful, then what rights do we have? You know, when does it become unlawful to be natural? And isn't it peaceful to just be and not go after needles and have needles brought into you? It seems like the peaceful situation is to live naturally. I'm not talking about, you know, someone with a contagious disease going around and running around in the public square. You know, I'm talking about a person who doesn't want to be forcefully medicated or forcefully tested, who just wants to be on their own private property or in a let's say like a national park, for example, just kind of living off the land. I mean, and these may sound like outrageous scenarios, but we're talking about examples of pandemic. And even in the great state of New York, when a pandemic was declared many decades ago, the public revolted. And many of them actually did, you know, literally run for the hills and not, you know, in their motor carriages. They went into the hills of New York, back to their cabins and their estates, fleeing from these public health measures that were considered draconian and not helpful. And eventually, the authorities had to back down from this. And so it's an example. And as the fabric, an emergency is declared because the fabric of society is under threat, or at least is being perceived as under threat. And so I think these are legitimate questions to ask and consider, just as the law review articles analyze and consider them, and the government obviously is taking them very seriously, so I think it's important that we do that as well.
Well, it seems, if I might step in briefly here, you've covered, of course, a lot of territory here. It appears, if I'm understanding correctly, that there are some scholars, legal scholars, that have kind of come down on different sides. It's certainly refreshing from my particular perspective to hear that there are legal scholars supporting the notion that we ultimately have a right to say, you know, no, even if our government and its finite wisdom thinks it's best for us or makes that assertion. But I can just imagine, as you've also, I think, stated or hinted anyway, that in the midst of panic or crisis, that local officials in particular, as you say, are going to be looking at the handouts and not really at the law, and in any event are going to be more apt to be the following orders, so to speak, if not literally, although perhaps literally, rather than, you know, certainly not being qualified or inclined to engage in discussion about where the proper legal boundaries are or should be. But I am heartened to hear that there's been at least one example, if not more historically, where people have said, whoa, wait a minute, enough's enough. And this raises real interesting points for me. I know back during the swine flu pandemic, there were several polls from around the world, including here in the U.S., that showed, for example, that a significant number, and in many cases a majority of healthcare workers, didn't want the swine flu vaccine. And I'm seeing that play out. This in past fall, I had by far the larger part of my practice involved working with healthcare workers trying to avoid primarily flu shots mandated by the hospitals, their employers. And most of them that come to me, if not all of them, say, you know, there's a bunch of other people back in my department or back at the hospital who don't want the vaccine either, but they're afraid to say anything because they think they'll be singled out as a troublemaker and be fired. Yeah. It's, you know, and it might sound like an overstated concern to some people, but I keep pulling up on my own mind Nazi Germany. You know, there were people,
yeah,
who saw what was going on. There were other people who denied it, but neither one of those were strategies that prevented it. And I feel like with vaccines, we're heading down, and there's a larger picture of which vaccines is just one piece. We could talk about the law that Obama just signed, bill that Obama just signed into law regarding allowing terrorists, even American citizens, to be held without being charged and indefinite detention and so forth. To me, it just screams so loudly of the violation of due process rights and speaking, as we have been today, of due process.
It's kind of like with whatever measure you measure is measured back to you. You know, the same way that Americans have treated people in Afghanistan and Iraq, now Americans will be treated like those victims. And so the example of Nazi Germany, I think, finds a particular parallel in the essence that, we would ask, you know, what was the crime committed by a Jewish person? There was no crime. That the person was just being natural. They were in their natural state, and the nation of Germany decided that it was insufficient to be natural. That these people had to be purged. And you find a similar logic applies to a person who is naturally unvaccinated. The state of America is saying that an unvaccinated person is not good enough. They're a problem. They're a plague upon society, and it's this presumptuous. It's a vile thought that the state of a peaceful natural man is not sufficient to live in ordered society, and I think that those who give in to that type of thinking will find themselves to have a mentality so deferential to the state as to be a moral failure to think in that way, to be so fearful of the state of a peaceful natural man that you'd be willing to require that everyone succumb to some sort of unnatural governmental intrusion, and that intrusion can take such a warlike character as to be, you know, to exterminate these individuals, to forcefully medicate them. And I use these terms here on this radio show, but I would ask listeners here to also remember that the Supreme Court has used terms that are just as strong in what would be an example, the Rochin case. That was a case where the United States Supreme Court was excluding evidence of narcotics following what happens is the police found this guy and he had swallowed a bunch of narcotics, and the police brought him to the hospital, and they forcefully injected the chemical solution down his throat that caused him to vomit the narcotics. And so then the police prosecuted him and wanted to use the evidence of the narcotics, and the guy said, you know, no, you can't use this. And the Supreme Court, this went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they compared the procedure that the police used to the old days of forced confessions through the rack and screw. It was this idea that there's certain things and the court said that we have to respect the certain decencies of civilized conduct. And it's this idea that ordered liberty is a status where we have these rights that have evolved from a history of oppression. And if we overlook these oppressions and simply engage in fear-based government, we will lose the very liberties that were necessary to the formation of a peaceful republic. Now, I'm not going to go so far as to say that there once was a peaceful republic. There's always been very tumultuous. But the goal is to try. And so this really brings us back to this premise of, where is the balance between where the police are allowed to exercise legitimate authority versus where can the individual exercise his right to be free from, unlawful medical procedures. And I found this treatise excerpt from – I really liked researching, and I found this treatise excerpt from a 1886, a legal scholar who wrote, And I say this to emphasize the history here. Okay, so, quote, "The police power of the state can never be exercised in favor or against any system of medicine. The police power can be brought to bear upon quacks and disreputable practitioners to whichever school they may belong. But when reputable and intelligent members of their professions differ in theories of practice, the state has no power to determine which of them, if either, is wrong." Close quote. Now, I found that treatise excerpt to be a fair statement of the understanding of the a common understanding of the law at that time, and at that time in history. And then, within 20 years of that statement, the seminal case Jacobson versus Massachusetts was decided, where the Supreme Court discussed forced vaccination and ultimately couldn't rule one way or the other on it. They just said that the public health authorities of this city called Cambridge, Massachusetts, were sufficient to allow this particular public health measure requiring vaccination or someone pay a $5 fine, but that the person challenging the law was free to leave the jurisdiction. So ultimately, forced vaccination was not at issue. But today, that case, which has never been challenged, is being used by the military-industrial complex, military authorities in America, to support and justify these draconian public health measures that would strip away these liberties. And so we are, as scholars, we're called back to reexamine what these historical opinions meant, where our historical liberties are, and what are our responsibilities to society today. And I think that we find that much of this discourse is very political, and we're not going to come to any particularly clear answers. But if we do learn from that statement that I just read from that legal scholar, we might find that, quote, "intelligent members of the profession differ in theories of practice, so the state has no power to determine which of them, if either, is wrong." Now, I find that homeopathy and naturopathic medicine to be a very legitimate profession, and that the long history of man has relied upon nature's bounty and herbal remedies to provide for our well-being, and that I also think that our mental states are very are integral to our physical well-being. And so the idea that common drugs and surgery, and then these toxic potions, vaccines today, are the one cure to our problems, I think to be a great fallacy. And part of this problem, which we were discussing about that we were discussing at the beginning of the show, a problem of a campaign of depopulation that isn't so much a conspiracy of a bunch of people in a room all deciding, but rather a system set up so that it doesn't, whether or not there are a bunch of people in a room deciding, it doesn't matter. The system is set up in such a way as to promote these, as to perpetuate these problems in a economic and military and political way that is like a boulder rolling down a hill that you just want to get out of the way of it. And so much of my research has been focused on educating where the law gives you the right to get out of the way of the boulder, to go self-quarantine on your own private property, to be able to exercise your personal and fundamental right to be peacefully natural. And so one of the things that we've talked about in particular on this radio program is vaccine exemptions and how they could be very helpful to you in not only exercising your rights, but also understanding your rights and having a confidence in exerting your rights. And it is a way to promote the fidelity to the legal system, to say, I'm not some loose cannon out here. I have I'm exerting my rights in a very ordered fashion, which is important because, as the Supreme Court has stated, we live in a society of ordered liberty, and we are trying to balance these rights and responsibilities. And so if you can go to your local medical doctor or local naturopathic doctor and choose wisely and ask them to evaluate your personal health and determine whether you should be injected with high levels of mercury and cell tissues of other animals and so forth, as is, or formaldehyde, as is contained in vaccines. If they can issue to you a statement signed by them which says that it is not in your medical best interest to, you know, suffer the fate of these vaccines, then there you have some, you know, objective medical evidence that you have an exemption to vaccines on the ground of your medical condition. And then, as Alan has also discussed in his book, Vaccine Exemptions, there are religious grounds and philosophical grounds and moral grounds upon which you can exercise your vaccine exemption. Do you want to go into some more detail on that, Alan?
Well, I had a couple of follow-up ideas or questions I would like to ask you to entertain a bit here, because
yeah.
A couple of things come to mind. First of all, I just want to say how refreshing it was to hear that there was a legal treatise that was saying, you know, let the people follow whatever experts they find persuadable, or let's have a society where
the government,
you know,
doesn't
we have
determine
that.
Who's right.
Yeah,
and who's
where the government doesn't make a determination from among credible people as to who gets to be valid and who doesn't get to be valid. It's such a refreshing and sort of common sense kind of thing. But also, a question that comes up in mind is, I hear you relaying just in general and collectively today the sharing the benefit of your obviously extensive and well-considered research. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I just really appreciate the work you've obviously done researching these areas extensively as you do, and then you obviously internalize and understand and communicate the information all very well. I keep coming back to practical questions. I hear what you're saying about the laws and the rights, and you are talking as well about some of the practical considerations, but I feel kind of like, well, let's assume just for the sake of conversation for a moment that the natural news prediction is true. I mean, I sort of, in my own mind, take it for granted that that has happened in the past and will happen again in the future, and I'm less specific in my opinion, just for lack of information, I think, as to when I think that'll happen, but maybe it seems to me probably inevitable. But even if we just consider it as a hypothetical, what do we do now in preparation of that? There's, you know, as you know, I've got a big push on legislation where I'm encouraging people to become legislatively active, because one aspect of this immensely complex and multifaceted vaccine controversy can be reduced to a somewhat simple, if definitely not easy, idea of let's get laws passed that create and protect, you know, our right to choose and our right to not be thrown into a quarantine facility of someone else's choosing if we decide not to be vaccinated in a declared emergency and vaccines are mandated. But it was refreshing to hear that there was a situation in New York where people just said, I'm out of here, forget this, and they left. What are some of the practical things we can do, do you think, Greg, aside from becoming legislatively active? What sort of things would you think we would be do well to have in mind, or maybe even actually do? I've just got a... the show I thought was scheduled for an hour, but I've just gotten a 90 seconds indicator here, so I don't know if we're going to if the show is going to shut off in another
can,
minute or so.
Give a short answer.
You're not, but go for a short answer and let's see what happens here.
Okay, so on the legislative point, I would invite the listeners to go to civilactionnetwork.org. I've proposed a new constitution for America to reboot the country that would allow the protection of this very right to be peacefully natural, along with a host of other changes to unseat the military-industrial complex and try to do some justice here in the world. And also, it's a wiki-based forum, so you can propose your own solutions, have other people vote on it. I think that raising awareness is very important, and talking to friends and family about these very important issues, and then promoting independent media. I think independent media will continue to grow in the years to come. But I also think that the years to come are going to suffer the natural course of cause and effect. What we reap, we will sow. What others have reaped, they will sow. And just as there are major powers in the world today, major nations and other powers that have functioned over the course of centuries to bring about the very world in which we are living and experiencing these problems, that will come to bear in a massive fashion. And so I think the time is now to embrace a philosophical approach, as well as the practical, which I just mentioned, but to embrace a philosophical approach of repenting and placing your trust where it counts, and that would be in the biblical Messiah.
Well, we've got legislative processes that are available, but as a practical matter, it can take years to get a law in place. I know one of my own state representatives has spent something like 16 years trying to get a licensing for naturopaths bill passed. And that, to me, I would think would be politically easier to do than to get vaccine freedom of choice laws passed, at least potentially. Not that I'm projecting or predicting years to get anything done with vaccines. I think there is a tide that is turning in the vaccine arena despite the extensive propaganda. But in the absence of laws and with the apparent very aggressive pro-vaccine agenda that's playing out on multiple levels. We've talked about a lot of that on this show. We'll talk about more of it in this year. And I've got some articles on that as well at the vaccinerights.com website, or linked either on that site or linked from that site. It wouldn't surprise me if there was this year was the year that another pandemic and man-made ultimately was released. And in the absence of laws, what we have, I think, available to us is, potentially anyway, is numbers of people unifying in a position saying, no, we don't, in effect, saying, no, these laws are not appropriate, therefore they should not be enforced, current laws, if they are inappropriate. And as seems to have occurred, as you were saying, in the New York example in the past, there's a huge, I think, psychological barrier that I think stands in the way of the vaccine choice agenda, and that is that many people can't wrap their minds, as I once couldn't, around the idea that there could be a problem with vaccines, or that there might be a more effective alternative. It seems that people can't get to the place where they will even really look at information that's opposing. It's the mechanism from a psychological point of view is that there's this worldview that seems to be consistent unto itself, the idea that, well, vaccines saved us from all these infectious diseases in the 1900s. We have to keep doing it. The logic, as it's been taught to us in school, seems sound. And so obviously anything that's a different point of view is wrong before you even look at it. And because of that wrong before you even look at it sort of mentality, or that component of a pro-vaccine worldview, many people, even very intelligent medical doctors and other professionals as well as lay people, will just immediately reject as crazy anything that's inconsistent with their pro-vaccine worldview. And so I have now, as a question that I carry with myself day to day and through my work, how do we, sort of an open ongoing question, how do we deal with that? How do we get past that? And I think that's something that we in this community, as a community, need to keep in mind, to recognize that it's not, many times it's not just about putting out the information, because a lot of times the information is rejected without even being looked at because of this underlying psychological barrier. And so I don't pretend to have the answer to this. It's something that I think we need to explore, but just a couple of quick ideas. I heard a psychologist in a YouTube video talking about how here we are 10 years or more now at this point after 9/11, and the information is out there that clearly refutes the mainstream and government assertions, and yet people are just not in large enough numbers to cause anything to be done about it anyway. People are not picking up on that. How is it that people are still not hearing this? And in that particular instance, we had the trauma of the actual 9/11 event, and then the same psychological phenomenon that I've been describing, and underneath that really is fear. What if we were right that 9/11 was an inside job? That would turn our world upside down and inside out. You know, and that's on a subconscious level, that's a really compelling fear-based protection mechanism that people who reject an alternative view will do. But I think it's a similar thing that happens with vaccines. But what the psychologist said was we need to reach out and connect with people where they are. And so, for example, I think one way that might apply to vaccines, if somebody says, oh, well, look at you know, all the diseases that vaccines got rid of during the 1900s, or any other refutable mainstream belief about vaccines. And one possible response to that is something like, yeah, I know what you mean. That's exactly what I used to think until I looked into it. There needs to be some way to reach out to them where they are rather than hitting them over the head from where we are, because many of them aren't going to be able to respond to that in a productive way. Another way, I think, to open the doors is to ask questions. You know, why do you believe that? Or, you know, have you ever seen the information yourself directly? Have you ever seen graphs of disease decline in the 1900s and where vaccines came? Ask questions that can lead them to perhaps information that they were otherwise closed to seeing or hearing. So, in any event, let's have that, you know, ongoing question. And in the meantime, I think we need to be asking, and we can address this question over time and in the future, I certainly hope, Greg, is what can we do? How can we network and connect with people? How can we help people get on the same page so that even if we're in the process of changing laws and haven't yet changed them, can we nevertheless have organization to the extent that if the proverbial poo hits the fan and we don't have a law we can point to that's an out that we can band together and in our collective, at least unofficial democratic fashion, just say enough is enough and we're not going to play this game. Mm. I mean, I'm sort of just, in one sense, grasping for straws here, but I'm thinking, you know, what do you do? Like when someone once told me, if someone comes to your door with a vaccine and there's an emergency declared, you know, what do you say? Well, the legal analysis is that person's not qualified to have the conversation about what are our constitutional rights, but I can tell you that if there was nothing else to say, I would have a conversation about constitutional rights. And I would say I'm an attorney, and I would, you know, argue that you don't have authority, and I would do everything I could to talk them out of going through with their agenda at my house, even if ultimately they had some legal authority for enforcing their agenda.
Yeah, that's already what I tried to do with trick-or-treaters who come to the door. I talk to them about constitutional rights.
That gets rid of them real quick, doesn't it?
yeah. You know, I like the approach of having a multiple phased intervention, you know, where it's, you know, each person is going to have their own strengths in conveying the information, and likewise, each person is going to have their own preferences in receiving the information. And so in the process of a multi-phased approach, you're going to be learning from the experts as well as you're going to be, you know, hearing your friends' opinions. And in the composite, you'll find a shift in your way of thinking. I think that's how it typically happens for most people. And if it only involves one level of understanding, like let's say it only involves a legal understanding or political understanding or a media-based understanding, it won't be sustainable. It's like a seed that falls on rocks. It doesn't have a foundation. You need a spiritual foundation as well.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more there. We are, believe it or not, getting near the end of our time here. But Greg, do you want to have any at least tentative closing comments on what we've talked about today? And we can certainly carry this further. Greg Glaser, attorney Greg Glaser from California, will be back on the show at least once a month. We'll have him back in early February. Any sort of closing comments you want to make about that, and then I'm going to go ahead and close the show out for today.
Sure. I'll offer a quote from the United States Supreme Court from 1990. Quote, "It cannot be disputed that the Due Process Clause protects an interest in life as well as an interest in refusing life-sustaining medical treatment." Close quote. Thank you for having me, Alan.
That is awesome quote there, and boy, I want to get that one from you after the show. Greg, thanks for being with us. We'll see you in February, and absolutely looking forward to that. Want to let folks know that our pull back up here to some notes here. We have regularly on Thursdays, right after this show, is a show with Dr. Christina Chambreau, a veterinarian, a doctor of veterinary medicine, and speaks about homeopathy and pets and homeopathy and hospice care. That show is going to be on tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern time rather than today, and I believe that's a change just for this week only, but we hope everybody will tune into that. Call in live, share with friends, tweet on Twitter, embed these shows on your websites or blogs. Do support these shows. We appreciate you listening today. We also had yesterday Dr., and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing this correctly, so I'll just apologize. It's A-A-D-I-L, Dr. Adil, a cardiologist, and I believe he's from India. He gave a talk yesterday on diabetes and homeopathy. You can listen to the archive or the podcast. So go to homeopathy.com and follow the links there, homeopathyworldcommunity.com, and Blog Talk Radio, and you can probably find it there as well. Appreciate your listening today, and we'll be back next week, Thursday at 12 noon Eastern time with Vaccines and Your Rights in the U.S. I certainly hope and believe that our regular co-host, Debbie Bruck, will be back with us next week. Debbie, we missed you today. Looking forward to having you back. And I'll be back as well. We'll be talking about more vaccine rights issues. And again, you're always welcome to call in and ask your questions or even email questions in advance. You can get information for contacting Debbie Bruck at homeopathyworldcommunity.com. You can get my contact information, Alan Phillips, attorney at law, at vaccinerights.com. And be sure and go to pandemicresponseproject.com, pandemicresponseproject.com, and see Greg Glazer's memorandum. He spent probably a couple of hundred hours researching that. It goes into great depth and detail about your rights in martial law and similar situations concerning vaccines. Incredible work, something you probably need to read more than once if you're like me to really begin to absorb what's in there, but it's a great reference piece. We will see you next week then.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Allow our souls to shine.